Business Trendsetter podcast, where we talk about trends and how to grow your business. My name is Manny Turan.
And I'm Adam Hartung.
We're here every week to bring you lots of insights on how to use trends, how to look at the world differently with respect to trends, so that you can use them to grow your business. And Adam, you know, we live in this world that's interconnected. We're all, the news is at our fingertips, and there's things that happen across the globe that affect us in an instant. And one of these things that is affecting lots of people is, of course, the downfall of Silicon Valley Bank. Now, that's one giant boulder that fell in this small pond that could have some ripples and repercussions to really the banking industry, and is really exposing some soft underbelly of what some of these banks are kind of working through. And we've talked about in the past, I mean, the banking industry is going to fundamentally change in the next 5, 10, 15 years. So what are your thoughts on the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, and how can entrepreneurs and business people be aware of that, of what happened, in order to grow their business?
Well, sure. And thank you very much. The Silicon Valley Bank topic has probably generated so much writing in the standard newspapers and so much news coverage over the last week that most people think there's nothing interesting we have to say. But I do think there are a couple of things interesting that we do have to say about what happened here. One of them is understanding your clients. And I think that Silicon Valley Bank made a mistake in that they didn't understand their client base as well as they should have. You know, we always talk about know your value proposition and know your value delivery system, and know how to separate the two. And if you have that quite clear, then you can know what your risks are, and you know what your opportunities are. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, they were primarily a B2B bank, meaning they didn't have a lot of Manny Durans and Adam Hartung as depositors nor as loan takers. Their business was really to offer loans primarily in the high-tech sector. And then they also banked with people in the high-tech sector. So checking accounts, what in the industry they call demand deposits. And they're called a demand deposit because you can walk in, demand your money at any given time, take your money out. Their clients were people in the tech industry, like Apple and like Facebook and Netflix and people like that. So a very important fact was that fewer than 5% of all the accounts at Silicon Valley Bank were less than $250,000. So that's, less than 5%. 95% plus of their accounts had over $250,000 in them. So that they should have understood, our value proposition is we serve these high-tech businesses. And these high-tech businesses, we make loans, we make bridge loans, we do various kinds of money transactions for them. And then we also hold the money that they use for their payroll and for paying their suppliers and people like that. And as such, they would know that the vast majority of their depositors were above the FDIC guaranteed limit of $250,000. That should cause the banking company to operate in a particular way to serve their bankers, right? So now there's a couple things they could do. You could have said, well, you know what? This is risky because we're strictly business to business with all these demand deposits that are in such these big accounts. If we started losing customers, it wouldn't take long for it to look like a run on the bank. You know, it takes a lot of Adam Hartungs and Manny Turans running down to the bank, taking our money out before anybody's ever going to notice. It doesn't take that many big tech companies or even medium-sized tech companies like a Twitter to say, I want to transfer my account. I got a demand deposit, might have $4 or $5 million in it. It wouldn't take very long for that to make a difference in the bank. And so they should have been aware that that was a risk, and they seemed to not be aware of that. The second part of that risk is they should have thought about that when it comes to how they did their loans and how they did their deposits. You know, the Great Recession of 2008, where we had the run on the banks and the banks almost all failed, you know, had a real big problem. That happened because banks had been led to believe that they could put their money into certain kinds of products called derivatives that they were told were very safe, when in fact those products were not safe at all. The investments that Silicon Valley Bank made that got them into trouble were U.S. Treasury bonds. These were not derivative instruments. These are instruments that are guaranteed to be paid. And so the second issue here, though, was taking a look and saying, okay, we're investing in U.S. Treasury bonds, but are we doing it in such a way that it's a safe deposit? In their case, they had taken a lot of money from depositors and put it in Treasury bonds that were low money. Remember, a year ago, interest rates were near zero. So interest rates, treasury bond rates, gone from 0 to 4.5% in less than a year. So they were putting money in these bonds. That's not a problem as long as nobody wants their money back. You just wait for the bond to mature, and then you buy more bonds at a higher interest rate. Right. But if people suddenly start moving and they want their money back, then you have to sell bonds. Well, because the interest rates have gone up, the bond value has gone down, and you're caught in a trap. Right.
Right.
And so they were not thinking about that significantly enough, that they were aware of their customers and aware of what their customer value proposition was and whether they could maintain that. The banking, what they were doing was helping tech companies be financially secure. Their value delivery system was the bank. Were they running that bank in a way to keep their customers financially secure? And the answer was no. Increasingly, there was this big gap between the amount of money they were returning and, you know, where their assets were and where their liabilities sat. And so consequently, it didn't take much of a run, and they were going to be trapped, and the equity would be eaten up kind of down to zero.
Yep.
The third piece about this I want to bring up is something called unintended consequences. And it's something that I see all the time in my work that I do with people. And that's where they say, well, okay, I'm going to move headlong forward with some kind of a plan. And they know what their objective is with the plan, but they're myopic about it. And they don't think, what could some of the unintended consequences be? Like, for example, let's take Elon Musk takes over Twitter, and he walks in the door and he says, you know what? I think that what I got to do to make Twitter a more successful company is I'm going to demand everybody come to the office. I'm going to demand that everybody sign a note. And it says that you're going to work 60 hours a week. And, you know, you're going to be one of the hardest working people. You're going to, you know, I want to, because what I want to do is I want to change the culture. Well, the unintended consequence was obviously vast droves of people walked out the door, yeah. Some of whom were very important to the company. So that myopic focus on what he wanted the culture to be caused this unintended consequence of a lot of good people leaving the organization. The unintended consequence that's happening here, the blame on the Federal Reserve. So you know that way back when the Federal Reserve first started raising interest rates, my reaction, and for every podcast since then, has been that this is a misguided policy.
Yeah, of course.
In fact, what's happening is we have inflation that's been caused because the inflation we had was caused that there was not enough supply when demand suddenly exploded. So we had people that were staying at home. They were masked up. They weren't going out shopping. They were not getting on airplanes and traveling because there were no flights. They were not getting on cruises and traveling because there were no cruises. There was a lot of things people couldn't do. You couldn't go to a national park. It's just things you couldn't do and things you couldn't buy. And then what happened was in a very short period of time, it took us like a year to drag into the pandemic and shut everything down, certainly 6 to 7 months. And even then, it took a long time to start shutting everything off. But when we said, okay, let's go ahead and declare the pandemic nearly over, we did it in like 2 or 3 months. And then none of the factories weren't ready to gear back up to produce that much of everything. You know, for many, many slaughterhouses had wiped out chickens without replacing the chickens. We had dairy farmers in Wisconsin pouring milk on the ground and finally having to exterminate or get rid of their dairy cows because there wasn't enough demand for dairy. So the capacity had shrunk, and it was going to take a while to bring that capacity back on again. And so prices went up. But, you know, Jerome Powell, who's not even an economist, he's a lawyer, but he's head of the Federal Reserve. He says, well, the number one thing you have to do at the Fed is you have to fight inflation. So consequently, I'm going to start jacking up interest rates. So he starts using interest rates to solve this supply chain problem. And the only way he can do that is to get people to quit buying. Then to get people to quit buying, he's going to keep raising interest rates. Well, people kept buying toilet paper and going out to eat McDonald's and all kinds of things. And maybe they stopped buying a few things like cars and houses. So he throws the housing market into, you know, a tailspin. Then he thinks, well, wait a minute. What's going to really happen here is we're going to get unemployment will go up, jobs will go down, demand will go away, because that's the classic. Well, the problem is he didn't look at the demographics. Because the demographics, unemployment isn't going down. People still are hurting to get people on the job. Mm-hmm. There's still plenty of jobs for the number of workers we have. And you can't solve a demographic problem by raising interest rates. But what you can do is throw a bank into turmoil. So here you have Silicon Valley Bank, who's been acquiring guaranteed, federally guaranteed treasury bonds, earning, you know, 1.5-2% at most, mostly about 1%. They're buying them up saying, okay, I got these demand deposits. I pay no interest on them. I'm investing at 1%. This is no big deal. But in very short order, those bonds went down in value because if they were 1% bonds, they were only $100 bonds, only worth $100 as long as the interest rate's 1%. When the interest rate goes to 2, 3, and 4, the value of the bond goes down so that you can earn 4% on that bond.
Yeah.
So now what happens is you have this gap that's created where the underlying asset went down in value. But the underlying asset wasn't a risky asset. It wasn't a derivative. It wasn't some investment in a high-tech startup that nobody in the name of it had no product for sale. Mm-hmm. It was an investment in treasury bonds. And so what the
which is that's supposed to be one of the most stable things if you have, yeah. if you have, wait long enough.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And literally, if they had not had to sell bonds, they would never have had a loss. In other words, if somebody hadn't said, if demand depositors hadn't started to walk in and say, hey, I want to take all my money out, everything would have just gone along fine. But when people started saying, I want to take my money out, then it became like that movie, It's a Wonderful Life, where you have Jimmy Stewart and there's a run on his savings and loan, and it's called a building and loan, you know, to be clear, in that movie. And he's headed on a trip and he runs back and people start saying, I want my money. And he tells him, look, you made an agreement with the building and loan. We have 30 days to give you your money. And they get in an uproar and he says, okay. So now he starts handing out money. Well, what does he have to do? Because he can't liquidate the assets, meaning the mortgages and the home loans that the building and loan would make, he has to reach into the equity. And the equity, of course, was his back pocket. And you see in the movie, he's taking money out of the till, and eventually he takes the money out of the suitcase that he was going to use for vacation, and he starts handing that out. Why? Because he's the owner of the bank. Therefore, he it was a cooperative, but figuratively, he's the owner of the bank. But he's putting his equity out. He's using his equity to cover those demand deposits. That's what happened with the Silicon Valley Bank. They have to start using equity to cover the excess the exits of the demand deposits, and they didn't have enough equity to cover it. They're selling the bonds at a loss, and now you're in a tailspin. So it started with not understanding the difference between their value prop and the value delivery system. Their value delivery system worked fine, but they didn't realize to meet their value proposition, they needed to be far less risky than they were. And there were ways to do that. I mean, they could have hedged the treasury bonds. They could have implemented other less risky investment process profiles so that if the demand deposits started to go away, then they could cover it. But they mixed them up and they were busy just trying to make money with the bank, and that caused the risk to grow in the bank. The second thing is this unintended consequences. In our strategies, what we often do is we don't think about how somebody we're not even looking at does something that has an unintended consequence on us, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like I always say with Blockbuster. It wasn't really Netflix that put Blockbuster out of business. It was Hughes Electronics and a bunch of defense companies, because they were inventing bandwidth. And they kept trying to accelerate how we could push bits down copper and then down fiber optic cable and eventually, you know, using wireless technology. As they kept improving bandwidth so you could put more information down a pipe, Netflix just took advantage of it. They said, oh, look, let's put a movie down the pipe. But Blockbuster, the unintended consequence of the bandwidth was eliminating the need for DVDs, VHS tapes, and CD-ROMs. That goes away when you get the bandwidth. So the unintended consequence of developing this bandwidth was actually the elimination of the traditional brick-and-mortar retail physical product, movie, and entertainment distribution. And that's one of the things I'd always try to get people to understand, why they have to keep looking at the outside world and why you have to pay attention to trends that you're like, well, what does that have to do with me? Remember the podcast we did about what's the price of tea in China?
Exactly.
And it's because these unintended consequences can completely take you down. And that's what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. If interest rates had not gotten jacked up by a Federal Reserve that went after inflation without thinking about what the unintended consequences of their actions would be, then they would never have been a problem. So they weren't prepared for a problem to start with. And then when the problem happened, it came from a place they never imagined. And that was what doomed
them. I'm curious to see, I mean, it's going to be likely impossible to know if there was anybody inside of Silicon Valley Bank that was raising an alarm. And if so, what was the result of it? I mean, obviously nothing happened, but it's always interesting to see if there's going to be an investigation. I'm sure they're in the middle of it. I haven't heard anything in particular, but I'm not sure if you have either. Have you?
Well, I do know the Justice Department started an investigation, and they're trying to find out if people see it coming and take money out that were in the bank? Did executives pay themselves a bonus? Did executives treat themselves well in advance of a failure, knowing that a failure was coming? That's the downside of it, I imagine. But I'm sure at the same time, the Justice Department trying to say, were there alarms going off? What was happening inside the organization, right? Because they're wanting to see what went on. But I want to kind of turn to another unintended consequence, and that's libertarians and Republicans. So a lot of libertarians are supportive of Republicans because libertarians are generally opposed to government regulation. And they think, let free markets be free. And that's the generic overlarge statement about libertarianism. Republicans tend to adopt a position as a party of less regulation is good. After the bank failures of 2008 and the problems we had, Paul Volcker headed up a council to put in a bunch of new rules to make sure that banks had proper securities and guardrails so that they could look at their asset base and they could say, are we prepared for a run on the bank? How much risk do we have and how protected are we? And how much reserves do we have to cover any kind of a run on the bank? Now, this was a pretty big step that they legislated into practice. And even people at the top of the banking industry complained about it. I went to school with Jamie Dimon. And so, I kind of track what goes on in that organization. I see him about once a year. And, a big bank like J.P. Morgan Chase was saying, man, these regulations are pretty onerous. And Jamie Dimon is pretty well known to be a Democrat. And he was saying, this is pretty onerous stuff. But, the big banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, the ones that were too big to fail, they had to go put these reserves in place. And it took them a few years, but they got there. But what then happened was that the more libertarian side of the political spectrum said, this isn't fair for the small to mid-sized banks. And the small to mid-sized banks don't have enough assets to be able to do what a J.P. Morgan Chase can do. And so consequently, we would like to have relief from those regulations. And that always sounds good, like let the little guy have relief, let the little guy be able to fight. And that was the relief on how you manage your reserves that allowed Silicon Valley Bank to have a situation where it had this wildly skewed checking account situation, where you had 95% of the people had uninsured money in their demand deposits. That couldn't happen at a Bank of America. You would catch it, and you would have to realign that, or you would have to add additional reserves in case you lost a lot of accounts. But they changed the regulations in order to make it easier for Silicon Valley Bank and other small to mid-sized banks. So then what happened was when Silicon Valley Bank gets caught, and they file bankruptcy, and then Signature Bank gets caught, and they have to file for bankruptcy. Then you have the people who invest in banks, which are millions of people, and pension funds and large mutual funds that invest in banks. They look around and say, you know what? All these small to mid-sized banks could be in the same situation. We don't know what the level of risk is in a small to mid-sized banks because they're not regulated by the big banks. And so consequently, the unintended consequence of trying to make it easy on the little guy was putting the little guy at risk of an event and then not having them secure, which hurts the equity investors more than anyone. The people who are supposed to benefit from the lower regulations get hurt because then you have the government has to swoop in to save the bank. And to do that, they have to wipe out the investor. And after they wipe out the investor, then they can do other things through FDIC insurance and take other actions to protect them. So do I think that the politicians that moved to decrease the banking regulations over time thought at all they were putting these small to mid-sized banks at risk? I doubt it. But again, it's unintended consequences. Yeah. Are you thinking about what could be the reaction or what could happen if you when you take an action strategically?
And of course, this is a great example of how everything is tied together. A government decree to raise interest rates has an unintended consequence of, 3-4 months down the line, it caused this issue. What else can a small business owner or executive consider based on what's been happening with the banks? I mean, should they be scared? Should they pull their own money out of the bank and put it into a bigger bank? Or what should they be doing at this stage? Obviously, we're not financial planners. This is, of course, an exercise of just exploration. But what could potentially a small business owner do as a result of what happened with Silicon Valley Bank?
Well, personally, I think that a small business owner does not have the responsibility of going in and looking at what is the demand or the loan profile of their bank. You've got a lot to do in a business. The banker down the street, you don't want to know everything about them. You should be able to have a level of trust in them. And actually, I imagine the executives of Silicon Valley Bank were trustworthy. They just got themselves into a mess, from not expecting the interest rates to go up. In this case right now, my view would be that anybody that has less than $250,000 in any account has nothing to worry about because they are FDIC insured. But what we've heard for the last week is that the government has said, look, we will protect demand deposits. So if one of these organizations gets into trouble, then we will take care of the demand depositors. We're not going to take care of the equity holders. So that's why the value, the equity value of so many banks has tanked. They've gone down 25, 45, even 60%. Mm-hmm. It's because people are saying, wow, do I want to have any equity in these banks? And I would say that if, you know, that you should know. As an equity investor in a bank, you should know this these profiles. You should know what the bank's value proposition is and what its value delivery system is. And you should know the level of risk. And you should have done your research and homework on that before you invested in a bank. If you didn't do that, then woe is you, mm-hmm. because you should have known. You should have paid attention. This information is publicly available. So I think as a typical businessman, I'd be unconcerned. As an investor in small and regional banks, I would be a bit concerned, because the third part of this is crypto. When Signature Bank went down, one of the board members is a guy named Barney Frank. Barney Frank helped write the Dodd-Frank bill, which put a lot of regulations on banks in place. And so here you had this guy that was Democrat from Massachusetts, who was all for regulating the banks. He writes a bunch of the code, gets the regulations adopted, he retires, then he's on the bank, and then this bank gets in trouble. And what he said was that they had invested in things like crypto exchanges, and they had started to accept cryptocurrencies, and they were unprepared for that. And cryptocurrencies have so much volatility that, in fact, the bank wasn't able to cover the variation in it. And that he had never envisioned that when they wrote the Dodd-Frank bill.
Yeah,
so that's another thing that I think I would pay a lot of attention to. What I don't do business with any bank or any other financial institution that does business in cryptocurrencies. As you know, I think that they're pure poo-poo. There's nothing there. They will eventually disappear. They're like baseball trading cards. And I wouldn't put my money in a bank that said the number one asset was collecting baseball trading cards.
Yeah.
I would say that as an investor, you should know whether or not your bank deals in cryptocurrency. If you're a business dealing cryptocurrency, you should realize the great risk you're undertaking as well, because those things have so much volatility and value. So that's, again, unintended consequences. We've let cryptocurrency go unregulated now for, 10, 15 years. It's time to get a hold of that so that we don't have this gamesmanship going out there of people screaming and yelling whether it's good or bad. But in fact, we say, look, if you're a currency, you're a currency. You abide by currency rules. And we make those markets act that way. We have middlemen in the markets, and we treat them the same way we treat the British pound. But until we do that, it's just fake. It's just fake, and you shouldn't pay any attention to it. But again, what I want to get back to is big, big trends. You know, so like cryptocurrency was a big trend. I think you ought to understand it. Realize you want to stay away from it. It's a hot wire. It's a live hot wire out there that could hurt you. And so, but do you do that? How many people do that? And you know what? There's a lot of people that don't, despite how much I yell about demographics, there is still rare that I come across somebody and I can say, how are demographics affecting your business? And they have an answer. Are you thinking about the aging population? Right. Are you thinking about, the population in which you live? You know, in the United States, 47 out of 50 states are losing population. And that's because the country isn't growing fast enough. Unless you're in Arizona, Nevada, and now I forgot the third one. I think it's Utah. Unless you're one of the, Texas, sorry. Unless you're one of those three states, you're losing population. What does that mean? That means that your tax base per person is going to have to go up. What you do as a government is likely to not shrink. Costs are going to grow. And as the costs grow, you're going to have to tax people more. So that's a problem. You better start thinking about it.
But if you're a politician or a business person in Wisconsin and you're losing people, what do you even do about it? I mean, you can't necessarily, obviously this is a rhetorical question here, but, how can these people actually make use of the knowledge of demographics in order to improve their state, improve their business in the state, and so forth?
Well, my recommendation to the Manufacturing Council of Wisconsin a year ago was that they do everything they can to get immigrants to come to the state. In other words, don't try to compete with Chicago and the state of Illinois for people that are going to school. Actually, literally, go and get on a plane and go to places like Ukraine or Poland or and other countries like that and say, hey, we would like you to come to our country and we would like to help you with immigration. Go down to the Mexican border and set up shop and say, when people come across the border, say, do you know how to lay bricks? Do you know how to be a carpenter? Do you know how to be a plumber? We have a shortage of all of those skilled tradesmen in our state. If you will come to Wisconsin and put up with the cold and but enjoy the natural beauty of our state, then we will do everything we can to get you, you know, a card so that you can work. You know, be proactive about going and getting immigrants to come in. And that was something that I was actually talking to the lead of manufacturing in Wisconsin. In fact, I think of him as the leader of manufacturing in Wisconsin. Great guy that runs manufacturing, the Center for Wisconsin Manufacturing Productivity, Buckley Brinkman. And he brought something to my attention that I was unaware. And it was a Washington Post article in which they put out some just a pretty simple fact. This wasn't a real long article. But between 1990 and the year 2020, I mean, maybe it was 1992, something like that in the year 2020, the population of Russia grew by 3%. That's not per year. It was 3% for that entire period.
How many years?
From 1990 to 2020, that's 30 years. During that same period, as much as we're complaining about the demographic aging and the problem we have in America, America's population increased by 30% in those 30 years.
Wow. Okay.
So here I am screaming to open the doors and let immigrants into the country because we have a population problem. In Russia, the problem is far, far worse. So here you have a country that was once a superpower. You know, it was once the Soviet Union and America. And then we added China in as a superpower. Then the Soviet Union exploded. And when it went away, it was broken down. Then that brought in Germany as a superpower and Russia as a superpower. But what's happened is Germany has continued to let a flow of immigrants into its country. It's been at the lead of letting immigrants into its country, which has grown the economy dramatically. We took East and West Germany, made them one Germany. That improved the size of the, you know, got a bunch more people in the country of Germany. We let immigrants from some of these Middle Eastern countries that are struggling. They come into the country. Some from North Africa come into the country. And while there are people that are dissenters about that activity in Germany, the economy has grown and it's been very good for them. Meanwhile, Russia hasn't had that benefit. Wow. And so one of the cold, hard facts that this postulated in the for the Washington Post writer was is the reason Russia is going out and annexing places like the Ukraine simply because they need the people, that they're becoming irrelevant, that they're not going to be able to continue to afford having cosmonauts. They're not going to be able to continue afford developing nuclear bombs. They will lose their position as a world superpower because they just don't have the people and they don't have the size of an economy to do so, especially as Germany and the United States and China keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that was the best example, the best thing I've ever seen yet for why Putin did what he did. Because if you read all the major journals around, nobody expected Putin to invade the Ukraine. Nobody. They said, okay, he's a tactician. He's a very bright man. He knows the world will be against him. He will never do this. He's got troops all along the border. He's still not going to do it. He's just going to threaten. You know, he'll never win. It's impossible for him to win. He'll ally NATO. And now, a year later, NATO's all allied with the Ukraine. We're all opposed to Russia. The Ukrainians are getting all the bombs and everything that we can give them. The war's going on. It's a war of attrition. It's a horrible thing. Eventually, Putin will give up. And this is where we are now. But this one article really puts more of an answer to it than anything else. He needs the people. If he wants Russia to continue to be a superpower, he needs the people.
This goes back to, you remember we had a conversation about China and why they were so fiercely protective during the COVID, the hardcore lockdowns, because they have the same problem.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, one of the best explanations, and I've been telling people this for about 2 years now, one of the best explanations for the way the Chinese treat the Uyghur population is that they absolutely need them to man the factories. In other words, if you could go in and you got a country and you're a dictatorial situation like it is there, I mean, it's not a democracy, and you've got the power to move people around, imprison people, do whatever you want. And you start saying, look, I need to bring in a group of people to man the factories. And there's a group of people who have stayed isolated, really haven't paid attention to the way we do things. They're a different religion, by the way, which teased me off because in my country, China, we're not into religion. We don't really like religion. And these people are very religious. And then what I do is I just encircle them and I suck them in and I say, okay, you lose all your rights and you're going to man my factories for me. And if we look at kind of why would China do this to the Uyghurs, that's one of the best explanations. Just simple, basic economics. We need that population, and we need, especially since the fact that they're having children. So this whole idea of demographics that people just kind of like pass over, like there's nothing I can do about it, I do believe is making a big difference in the world stage. I believe it's a big reason why Xi Jinping is behaving the way he is, and he's interested in taking over Taiwan. I feel very confident that it's the best explanation for why Putin for over a decade has been trying to annex smaller states and now the Ukraine. And you need to look at that and say, well, what does that mean for us? What does that mean for, you know, what's happening in our country, what's happening to our businesses? Now, we may not be senators and congressmen and have that ability to deal at that level of what happens in Russia.
But it's all interconnected. If you're expecting something made in Germany, some German goods, and they're having a problem with obtaining natural resources that they were formerly getting from Russia, like natural gas, it's going to have an effect on your ability to get product from Germany. I mean,
absolutely.
It's all tied together.
And so if you're sitting here calmly saying, oh, you know what, that war is far away and I don't need to pay attention to it, the answer is wrong. This war could go on for a while. As you said, Russia is very important in terms of supplying natural gas and crude oil. They're sitting with a long border with China. They could start to, you know, they could partner up with China and give them more of those natural products, making it harder for people in Europe to get those products, which then affects the balance of production in the United States, which then affects our ability to negotiate effectively with China, which allows China to get more resources in order to try to take over Taiwan, which could cause us to have an additional problem of even greater shortage of computer chips, which is what started the supply chain problem in the first place. They got the Fed so excited. So yeah, it does come around full circle.
It's all tied together.
But if we could, I want everybody to walk away from this one thinking about the fact that often it's unintended consequences that get us. Just keep your eyes open, look into the outside, know the risks of your value delivery system as you try to fulfill your value proposition, and realize that the biggest threat to your business, the thing that could really put you away, will really most likely come from outside your view. So the only way to avoid that is keep enlarging your view.
Very well said, Adam, and an invitation to our listeners and viewers to reach out to Adam and I and our team to help you to understand and look around to identify the things that you don't know. And some of those things are very important in order to prevent some calamities or catastrophes based on these calamities that are happening around the world. With that, Adam, have a wonderful rest of the week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Manny.
Cheers.